Good morning, everybody. Wow, there are a lot of you. It is wonderful to be back at Chalk Valley. And let me take you to the most exciting episode of 1980, a moment of really gripping drama. Unforgettable, really. The World Snooker Final in Sheffield, May the 6th, 1980. Hurricane Higgins. Yes, Hurricane Higgins against Cliff the Grinder Thorburn. We were absolutely gripped as a nation. 14 million people were watching this programme. Alas, I don't think you can hear the soundtrack on here. It is mostly, this was the Embassy World Snooker Final because it was sponsored by Embassy Cigarettes. And those were the days. If you could hear the soundtrack, it's mostly people coughing. And it was incredibly exciting. It was the most exciting snooker ever gets, actually. And it was down to the final frame. I was with my dad. It was bank holiday. I was 17. Nothing much was happening. And then it froze at this moment. And it moved to this. So that's the initial moment that the SAS assaulted the Iranian embassy overlooking Hyde Park. I don't know if you can hear the soundtrack for this, but already you can hear the sounds of dogs barking in the back, gunfire, more explosions, tear gas going off. You can probably just hear it there. In fact, it's hard to tell because you've got gunfire coming from here as well. It's great to have a double soundtrack. That's marvelous. So the building caught fire almost immediately because the gunmen inside had soaked key parts of it with kerosene and lighter fluid and everything they could get that was inflammable. The fire brigade was quite late turning up, in fact, because it was so dangerous. It was thought that they would be killed if they got too close too early. As you can see, the building's on fire. These are the first of the SAS arriving inside the building. That is one of the SAS soldiers beckoning to Sim Harris, one of the BBC journalists who'd been trapped inside for 6 days. Sim Harris, I'm delighted to say, is still with us. He refers to that as his balcony scene. To understand what was happening on that May bank holiday, May 1980, you have to go back a year to the Iranian Revolution, in which the Shah of Shahs, the King of Kings, the monarch of the peacock throne, was overthrown in a bloody revolution and replaced by the fundamentalist Islamist regime of the Ayatollah Khomeini. That event, arguably, was the single most important episode of the latter half of the 20th century. Everything in Middle Eastern history flows from that, including what is happening in Iran and Israel today. It's the key moment. The revolution in Iran awoke all sorts of expectations among the Iranian people, who had been brutally oppressed in many cases by the Shah's regime for a very, very long time. And among the people who expected to benefit from this event were the Arab minority in southwest Iran, Khuzestan. They called it Arabistan. The Persian speakers called it Khuzestan. 4 million Arabs who had really been oppressed by successive Iranian regimes from the beginning of the foundation of modern Iran. They expected the revolution would bring them civil rights, freedoms, the right to teach Arabic in schools in Khuzestan. That didn't happen. Instead, the Ayatollah's brutal security service and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards clamped down brutally on the Arab minority, stopped any form of protest. Hundreds of people were killed. Now, among the people that this radicalized were these six young men. They had all lost family members in what they called Black Friday, this appalling repressive attack on them, which doesn't justify what they were doing, but it sort of begins to explain it. These six young men arrived in London intent on staging a terrorist spectacular against the Iranian regime. They were opposed to the Ayatollah. They chose Britain in large part because they thought they would get a fair hearing in Britain. They believed that the British government, Margaret Thatcher's government, was pretty much on their side. And their aims were actually, in a way, quite simple and staggeringly naive. They believed that they would be able to take hostages. They wanted to take Iranian hostages, that representatives of the new Iranian government, take them hostage, use them as bartering chips, really, to exchange for Arab prisoners held in Iran. They wanted their message to be broadcast on the BBC, and then they wanted to go home. They believed, and it sounds extraordinary, that they would be provided with an aircraft, and they would then be flown back to the Middle East. Now, that sounds, as I say, astonishingly naive, but actually, in the strange grammar of 1970s terrorism, it was not unheard of. This was a time when some governments were still prepared to negotiate over hostages and actually to grant free passage to people who perpetrated this kind of incident. So it wasn't unheard of. What they failed to take into account, these six young men, was one crucial factor, and that was Margaret Thatcher, because she was not going to accede to that. So these six young men formed this plan. But what nobody really realized at the time, and in fact this has really only come out recently, was that the whole thing, the whole plot, the whole decision to attack the Iranian embassy was actually fomented and created by Saddam Hussein. This was an Iraqi plot intended to destabilize the Iranian government. And the Iran-Iraq war, the brutal conflict, eight-year conflict between Iran and Iraq, would erupt a few months after this incident. So in a way, this was the kind of first battle of that war, but fought out on the streets of London. And the two other people, so you see Saddam on the left. On the right is a man who was called Sami Muhammad Ali. He was an officer in the Mukhabara, the brutal Iraqi security service. He was the person who accompanied these young men to London. He provided the weapons which were shipped into London in the diplomatic bag to the Iraqi embassy. And he told them before they went into the assault, he said, there's one thing, don't start before 11 o'clock on Monday morning. Now, that was because at 11 o'clock on that Monday morning, Sami Muhammad Ali climbed onto an aeroplane to France and was never seen again. And the man in the middle is, again, a shadowy figure in this story. This is Abu Nidal. Abu Nidal would go on to become the most notorious Palestinian terrorist of all. He killed hundreds of people. At this point in 1980, he was at the beginning of his terrorism career, if you can have such a thing. And he was advising Saddam Hussein on terrorist activities. So he is the mastermind behind all of this. So these six young men are in many ways manipulated pawns in this story. They didn't realize just how much they were being used. So let me paint you the scene. It's 11:10 on a drizzly Monday morning. This is the Iranian embassy. You can see it in the middle with the Iranian flag. It still is the Iranian embassy. It looks out over Hyde Park. At 11:10, these six young men burst through the front door, firing machine guns, submachine guns. The first people they met were... Is this working? There. On the left, that's PC Trevor Locke. Now, Trevor Locke is one of my favorite characters in this whole story, because PC Trevor Locke is, as he said to me once, he said he was an ordinary Bobby from Barking. He'd been a beat Bobby all his life. He was the last person who wanted to get caught up in something like this. In fact, he'd signed up for the Diplomatic Protection Group, which is the section of the Metropolitan Police that looks after embassies. He'd signed up because it was boring. Nothing ever happened. All you had to do as a Diplomatic Protection Group officer was to stand on the doorstep and smile at the visitors coming in and out. That was it. He said to me once, he said, I wasn't the Sweeney. He said, I was Dixon of Dot Green. He said, I'd signed up to help old ladies cross the road. And that is what he'd done all his life. And that's what makes him so interesting, I think, because he's the last person to want to be a hero. And yet he was. This story brought out astonishing reserves of courage in that man that he had no idea that he possessed. He was also carrying a gun. One of the reasons why the gunman had chosen Britain was because they'd been assured by Sami Muhammad Ali that British policemen were unarmed. They didn't carry weapons, and therefore they could do this with impunity. No one was going to shoot them. In fact, the Diplomatic Protection Group did carry guns. Trevor Locke had a revolver on his holster underneath his very heavy tunic. It was a cold day. They didn't find that gun. They searched everybody initially, the gunman, but they did not find Trevor Locke's gun. And he kept that gun on his hip for the next 6 days, secretly, wondering whether and when and how he would be able to use it. It's kind of, in a way, the kind of that is one of the ticking bombs, and that gun plays a very important part in the final part of this story. On the right is another of the British hostages. Now, the gunman had no idea there were any British people inside this building at all. They thought it was filled with Iranian diplomats. The man on the right is Ron Morris. Ron Morris was the major domo of the Iranian embassy. He was the man who was in charge of making sure that the place ran properly. There was enough loo paper and enough kerosene for the generator. And his main job in the embassy was to make tea. And that is what he did for the next 6 days. Ron was one of those people for whom there is no crisis so great. There is no moment so dramatic and frightening that it cannot be solved with a nice cup of tea. And you'll see later on, he is serving tea throughout. But again, he plays a very important part because it is these ordinary people, these inadvertent participants in a roiling, terrifying drama that in a way are the central characters. Let me introduce you to one or two others who were inside that building. Top left is a man called Mustafa Karkouti. He was a Syrian journalist, Syrian Arab, who just happened to be in the embassy because he was interviewing one of the diplomats. He plays a very important part because Karkouti was the only person in that building who spoke, well, he spoke Arabic, which was his native language, and that was the language of the gunmen. He spoke perfect English, so he could communicate with the police outside, and he spoke Farsi, the language of Iran. So he was the only person who could communicate with everybody, and so inadvertently, he became a kind of intermediary in this story. Again, he plays a very important part. Bottom left, you see Roya Kagachi. She was an Iranian employee of the embassy. She was not pro-Ayatollah at all. She had worked for the Shah's regime. In fact, she thought that the Ayatollah's lot were rather sort of embarrassing and sort of she weren't at all her sort of thing. There were women inside this embassy. Their stories have never been told before. There were six of them, and they've really been written out of history, really. Roya Kagachi was the senior secretary. She was the person who knew, as anyone knows, the person who really knows how an embassy runs is the senior secretary. And again, her knowledge of the layout of the building and where the food was and how to keep everybody calm and where the loos were, she plays a very important part. On the right-hand side, you have two of the Iranian diplomats. At the top is Ali Ghanzafar, who was the most senior Iranian diplomat in London. He was a new appointee. He was an ideological appointee because he really knew nothing about diplomacy. He was in the position because he was a devotee of the Ayatollah. And below him, again, a key figure. This is the last complicated Iranian name I'm going to throw at you this morning. This is Ali, what's his surname now? I can't even remember. It'll come back to me. But he was the press officer, the junior press officer, Lavassani, Abbas Lavassani. But he was also secretly an officer in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. He was a fanatical supporter of the Ayatollah, a full-fledged Islamist. He'd taken part in the attack on the US embassy, which was still ongoing. There were still 55 hostages, American hostages, inside the American embassy. And Abbas Lavassani had been one of the people that took part in that operation. So his role in the embassy was really as a kind of ideological enforcer. He was there to make sure that all the Iranians towed the correct line with the Ayatollah. And in many ways, he was just as radical as any of the gunmen. And it is the sort of collision between these two irreconcilable schools of political thought that are the ticking time bomb under this story, because there is a conflict brewing from the very first moment. And this is Sim Harris, who you saw leaping across the balcony at the beginning. Sim gets his own photograph because Sim is, I'm delighted to say, still alive. And his contribution to this book is extraordinary because he was a journalist. He was a sound recordist for the BBC. He was quite experienced. He had worked in Iran before. He spoke a little bit of Farsi. But his first instinct when this drama began to unfold was to start taking notes. He began to keep a contemporary diary of what was actually going on inside that building. Now, for a narrative non-fiction writer, that is absolute gold dust. because that allowed me to say what was happening moment to moment. And Sim not only kept notes, he would draw little drawings of everybody as it was going on. And I asked him recently, I said, why did you do this? And he said, it was just a journalistic reflex. He just said, I thought I was going to die, but I wanted to leave something behind. And thank goodness he did. Because in that photograph, that footage you saw at the beginning, as Sim Harris is scrambling out of that burning building, his jacket is actually on fire. You can't quite see it from the footage. But tucked into his pocket are a sheaf of notes, which he'd never shown anybody before. This is another set of sort of souvenirs. Now, one of the gunmen, the youngest gunman, found in one of the drawers of the embassy an old Kodak Instamatic camera, something that, you know, then was the cutting edge of photographic technology. Now it would be an antique. And one of those gunmen began taking souvenir photographs, which just gives you an idea of the fact that these men intended to survive, that they were not a suicide squad. They were radical enough, and they were prepared to kill, and they were prepared to die. But they were not, they intended to get out of this alive. So the photographs you see at the top right, bottom right, and bottom left, these are three of the gunmen posing for the camera, holding up V for victory signs, brandishing their weapons. But the photograph that really fascinates me is the top left. That's a group photograph of the hostages. Because the gunmen were growing quite close to the hostages by day two or three. So there you see Trevor Locke, on the left, looking rather serious in his uniform. He never took his uniform off for reasons that I'll explain. Next to him is Mustafa Karkuti, grinning to the camera. On the right, you see Sim Harris, again in the foreground, again smiling quite happily for the camera. At the back, you see Ron Morris, top right, serving tea. And in the middle is probably my favorite character. This story has moments of high comedy in it. Parts of it are absurd. And I think that sort of, in a way, is reflective of very tense situations. I think when people are under great stress, one of the ways that they relieve it is through humor. The man in the middle was called Ali Gul Gahanzafar, and he was a Pakistani tourist who had wandered into the embassy by mistake. Ali Gul was rather overweight, and he'd been wandering around Hyde Park for some hours, and he was just rather tired. So he thought, I'll just go and sit down in the waiting room. Later on, he claimed that he was there to meet someone. He really wasn't. He was just a bit puffed out. And Ali Gul never quite got a grip of where he was, because he kept saying to the gunmen, can I go home now? Because I've got a plane to catch and I need to be in Lahore on Thursday. And they kept saying, it's not quite like that. You're actually a hostage and you're a captive. But oddly, he was released early. During the hostage negotiations, at one point, in return for food and cigarettes being sent in, the gunman agreed to release someone. One of the things about Ali Gul Gahanzafar was that he snored like a train. And it kept everybody awake. So when the moment came to release a hostage, the gunman looked around and said, let's get rid of him. So Ali Gul was in fact released early. I think he's the only person in history who gained his liberty through snoring. So while all that is going on, is that working? There we go. Hostage negotiations are taking place. The photograph you see on the left is the chief hostage negotiator, a man called Fred Luff. There were six police negotiators brought in. They were trained, but really not very adequately. Their main role was just to try and keep the gunmen talking. The photograph you see on the left is actually a very brave photograph. He is well within range of the submachine guns that these guys were carrying. Behind him, again, very bravely, you see his translator wearing a fur coat. Under the fur coat is a bulletproof jacket. She's sort of clinging onto him, and she's trying to translate what's going on. On the right, you sort of see the counter photograph, which is Sim Harris and Trevor Locke talking to the police negotiators face to face. Eventually, they would introduce a field telephone, which meant they didn't have to do this face to face. But you can tell from the body language on the right there, Sim Harris is pleading with the police. He is saying, get us out of here. Because already, and this photograph was taken on day two, the end of day two, you're seeing evidence of Stockholm syndrome is beginning to emerge. Now, many of you will have heard the phrase Stockholm Syndrome. That emerged from an incident that took place actually sometime after this in 1986, when a bank robber took over a bank in downtown Stockholm, took six hostages, held them for a week, and then the police attacked with tear gas and they were all brought out bloodlessly. But one of the extraordinary things about that hostage situation was that the captives not only refused to testify against the people who had held them hostage, they actually began to raise money for them, to support them. And in at least one case, one of the women developed strong romantic feelings for the gunman. Now, that's an extreme case of Stockholm Syndrome. But what happens in Stockholm Syndrome, and it happens in almost every hostage situation, is that a kind of community of interest begins to develop between the hostage takers and the hostages. And frequently, this is aimed at the people outside. It becomes clear to the people inside, even though it's not clear at all, that somehow the police and the army and the politicians are conspiring against them. And in this photograph, you see Sim Harris pleading with the police to agree to these gunmen's demands. End this thing, because you can end it. Now, the flip side of Stockholm Syndrome is what they call Lima Syndrome, much less well known, again named after a hostage-taking incident in Lima, in which the reverse happened, which is where the gunmen began to develop such an affinity for the people that they'd taken prisoner that they couldn't go through with their threats and their demands. You get both Stockholm Syndrome and Lima Syndrome starting almost from the moment that this incident kicks off. Meanwhile, outside the embassy, all hell is breaking loose because hundreds of Iranian students have turned up believing that this whole thing has been orchestrated by the CIA as a retaliation for the US embassy hostage crisis in Tehran. Of course, that's nonsense. That is not what this is about. But it takes a long time for the Iranian authorities to realize this isn't a tit-for-tat operation. So huge numbers turn up, and you can see the Albert Hall in the background there. So naturally, when a demonstration like that takes place, a counter-demonstration starts, and the British all turn up, not all of them, but lots of them, carrying Union Jacks with very little idea of what is going on inside, with signs saying, "Free the copper." They're followed by a group of skinheads from Tottenham supporters mostly, who turn up and begin a pitched battle with the Iranians. So there are running battles taking place across Hyde Park, which the police are trying to control. The police, I have to say, having never heard most of them of, I'll just move to the next slide if I may, there we go. Having never really heard of Khuzestan, no one had heard of Arabistan. This was a completely new story for the police. And the man in charge of trying to understand and get his grip around this is the man you see on the right, Assistant Commissioner John Dello, who was in charge of operations at Scotland Yard, which really meant crisis. And Dello was an extraordinary man. He had an almost kind of uncanny calm about him. He never got rattled, except once when a figure arrived in this story that he could not have anticipated and did not know how to deal with, and that was Prince Andrew. One of the truly bizarre aspects of this story was the discovery that right in the middle of it, Prince Andrew demanded to be allowed to come and watch. He wanted to sit in Zulu control alongside John Dello and kind of advise him on what was going on. John Dello said, "This is not going to happen." But Prince Andrew was, and I suspect still is, a person that it's quite hard to say no to. So he asked again and again, and eventually John Dello, this is the only time in this whole six-day drama, the only time that John Dello lost his temper was when he told the palace, Prince Andrew was not coming anywhere near. Meanwhile, the press, this is the biggest story in the world. 300 journalists turn up and are encamped outside the Iranian embassy in a special enclosure, which they called Pressville. And so they were there also trying to get the story, trying in some cases to actually break into the embassy. Those were the days. It was a huge scrum. It was the biggest breaking story in the world, bringing yet more pressure on poor old John Dello. Let's go to the next one. So one of the first things that John Dello authorized was what he called an audio assault on the building. This meant trying to introduce eavesdropping devices to try and work out what was going on inside there. So what you see here is a still photograph of an MI5 officer lowering a bug down the chimney. There were 12 chimneys on the Iranian embassy. By the end of the assault, each of those fireplaces had dangling out of sight inside it an eavesdropping device to try and listen to what was going on inside. At the same time, police technicians and MI5 were drilling microprobes from either side. So on one side of the Iranian embassy, you had the Ethiopian embassy, and on the other, the Royal College of General Practitioners. Beautiful building. It had formerly been the US ambassador's residence. That was the sort of main headquarters for GPs in the UK. Now, on both sides, they began drilling in. These things sound very rustic to us today, but believe it or not, in order to introduce a microprobe through a 2-foot wall on either side, brick and granite, they used hand drills. These things made a very distinctive squeaking noise. The idea was that once you got through to the plaster on the other side, if you introduced a microprobe with an audio with a microphone on the end, just before the plaster, just without going through the plaster, you could hear what was going on inside. But as I say, it made a noise. So much of a noise that Tawfiq al-Rashidi, who was the chief, the man, the chief of the gunmen, became very rattled. He heard this noise and he summoned Trevor Locke and he said, Mr. Trevor, come and listen to this. And so Trevor Locke did what he was told. He went upstairs and they listened at the wall. And Trevor Locke, who was a brilliant man in lots of ways, turned to Tawfiq and said, "Oh, Tawfiq, I think you've got mice." Which was, of course, complete nonsense. And Trevor knew it was nonsense. And indeed, Tawfiq, who was no fool, knew it was nonsense. But that conversation was overheard by the eavesdroppers. And they realized they had a problem. So the best way to cover a small noise is to make a big noise. That was at least John Dello's conclusion. So he contacted the gas board. 2 hours later, two men in overalls with two very large pneumatic drills arrived in front of the embassy and began digging a very large and completely unnecessary hole. The noise was absolutely deafening, so much so that nobody could concentrate on what they were doing, including the police. So they stopped that and came up with an even more bizarre idea. Try to imagine doing this today. Dello contacted the Civil Aviation Authority at Heathrow and arranged for planes coming in and out of Britain's largest airport to fly low over the embassy. And jets in those days were a lot louder than they are today, to try to drown out the noise. So the police technicians would wait until they could hear a plane coming. And as it went over, they'd drill like mad into the wall. And as the sound sort of went into the distance, they'd stop. Believe it or not, it worked. By day 6, police had a pretty clear idea of what was going on inside that building. This is just some of the intelligence reports that were being gathered over time. They didn't know everything. They didn't know everybody that was inside that building, but they had a pretty good idea. And they also had an idea of who the gunmen were. You see these sort of rather extraordinary sort of photo fit pictures, and they're strangely accurate because they realized that unless they knew who these people were, there was no way they would be able really to negotiate with them. But the pressure was building. Every day, the gunmen would make another demand, another threat, in this case, to blow up the entire building. And nobody knew whether they had enough explosives to do that, by the way. I mean, the police, right to the end, were never sure just how much they had in the way of explosive material. The Cobra Committee, the government's emergency response committee, was convened on day 1 under the chairmanship of Willie Whitelaw, then the Home Secretary. It sat 24 hours a day for the next 6 days. Essentially, the political group that was monitoring what was happening and making the key decisions. Willie Whitelaw ran it, but really the power behind it was Margaret Thatcher. Now, Thatcher had only been in power for less than a year by this point. Her grip on the government and the cabinet was still quite fragile. She was still a very controversial leader. And this story, in many ways, brings out both the best and the worst of Margaret Thatcher. She was absolutely clear about what she wanted. She made it clear from the very first minutes that these gunmen were not going to be given what they wanted. They were not going to be allowed to walk free. They had committed crimes on British soil, and therefore they would be tried in British courts. She also ruled that while if one of the hostages was killed, the hostage negotiations could continue for a time. She didn't want to stop it immediately. If two died, that was the red line. That was the moment when the SAS, as it turned out, would be sent in. So that was, in a way, she was very resolute. She took a huge gamble. She really gambled with her premiership, because if this had gone wrong, the history of this country would have been very, very different, and I'll come to that in a moment. On the other side of the coin, however, Thatcher would have made a very bad police negotiator, because she really gave the police nothing to negotiate with. They couldn't offer the gunmen anything they really wanted. And she went too far, in my view. She refused for many days to allow their statement to have been broadcast on the BBC, which would have done no harm. More importantly, she also refused their request to have an Arab diplomat brought in to help negotiations. It's my view that she could have agreed to that without any loss of face. But Thatcher was, as I say, absolutely adamant that nothing that they wanted should be agreed to. Actually, the reason I'm showing you this photograph of her with Jimmy Young, the housewife's choice of Radio 2 on the bottom, is that actually when this whole thing erupted, she was being interviewed by Jimmy Young. It was a very long interview. And as she emerged, somebody said to her, "Mrs. Thatcher, what do you think about the situation at the embassy?" And she said, "Well, it's a disaster." She said, "The police have totally lost control. They don't know what they're doing. The authorities are absolutely out to lunch. The thing's ghastly." And everyone went, "Really?" And actually, she was talking about the other embassy siege, the one that was taking place in Tehran. So she was actually talking about the Iranians, not about her own government. So it was a confusion that had to be cleared up pretty quickly. Let's do the next one, because I think it is time. Is this working? Can you flip to the next one? There we go. To bring in the SAS. Ever since 1972, the SAS had been training for a hostage situation of this type. The building you're looking at here is known as the Killing House. It is in the middle of the Hereford SAS headquarters, and it's where they practice hostage rescue and hostage negotiation. Actually, the royal family is occasionally brought here in order to see what it's like to be in the middle of a hostage-taking situation. Princess Diana, she then once went there, and her hair caught fire thanks to a thunderflash, but apparently she was very polite about it. But this is where they practiced picking out hostages and eliminating hostage takers. So they've been doing it for a very, very long time. At this point in 1980, B Squadron of SAS was on standby. And these are, again, souvenir photographs, never published before, of the SAS preparing in the next door building. Within hours of this thing kicking off, B Squadron moved into the Royal College of General Practitioners, fully armed up, fully ready to go in. And what you see here are the troopers preparing for the assault. So at the bottom, you see them studying scale models built by a police carpenter of each floor of the embassy. So within those wooden structures are little Sabutio figures representing the gunmen and the hostages. And they are being moved around the building as the audio assault reveals where everybody is, or they think it does. Top right, you see them looking at the intelligence boards. These are the sort of photo fits of the gunmen, designs of the weapons they're carrying, again, layouts of the building. So they're trying to memorize what's going on. And top left, you see what I imagine the SAS always does in its spare time, which is pointing guns at each other. As you can see, they are fully tooled up and ready to go in. I mentioned to you at the beginning Abbas Lavassani, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. On the morning of day six, a furious confrontation erupted between one of the gunmen, a man called Jassim, and Abbas Lavassani, an ideological fight, if you like. It was kicked off by Jassim drawing anti-Ayatollah graffiti on the walls of the embassy, and it became very physical. And at the end of it, Abbas Lavassani tore open his shirt and said, "If you want a martyr, I will be your martyr." And Jassim, who was an extremely brutal man, said, "Right." They took him down into the hall. They tied him to the banister at the bottom of the hallway, and they executed him with three bullets to the back of the head. That gunfire was heard, obviously, by the audio probes. and it was about 11 o'clock in the morning. But at this point, police did not know whether anyone had died. They thought that somebody had probably been killed, but they couldn't be sure. And Thatcher's rule was you had to have two bodies. So there was a strange standoff for the next 5 or 6 hours. And then what you see here, it's rather grainy, I'm afraid, is the body of Abbas Lavassani being carried out. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they rolled his body out of the front door. The police put it on a stretcher, took it away. A very quick post-mortem established that Abbas Lavassani had died several hours earlier, probably 6 hours earlier. And they'd heard another volley of gunfire. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, like that, another set of gunfire went off. So the assumption, wrong as it happened, was that two hostages had been killed, and that was the signal for the SAS to go in. It's not working on me. 1907, John Dello tore a page out of his notebook and formally handed over authority to the SAS. It's the only time that I'm aware of that this very obscure clause in British law, military aid to the civilian power, has been invoked on the mainland. So for a very brief period from 1907 in the evening, this was martial law. The military were taking over. Next one, please. There we go. For the last 6 days, a man called Hector Gullen, the leader of B Squadron, had been framing up Operation Nimrod, the assault on the Iranian embassy. Now, attacking, it's what they call in military parlance a stronghold assault. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's particularly difficult to do if the people you're attacking are waiting for you to attack. So this is a very difficult operation, and I'll just flick through it very quickly. From those footage you saw at the beginning, it looks as if there's just one assault on the embassy. Actually, the embassy was being attacked from 6 different points. Thank you so much. Lovely. So there are the group going in through the front, Group A. There was a problem there already because the building had been recently rearmored. The Shah's government had asked the British government to help it make the building more secure, and the people brought in to advise on that were the SAS. So the poor old SAS was attacking a building that it had itself reinforced. Those windows at the front were all armor-plated, so the soldiers had to put on a lot of explosives. In fact, they put on so much explosives, they blew off the balcony. At the same time, another team would abseil down the back to the room at the back where they thought the hostages were being held, which had a balcony outside it. Then they'd blast into that with thunder flashes and stun grenades and tear gas and try and collect the hostages together. Two more assault teams were going to go in through the ground floor, one into the basement, one into the ground floor, and yet two more would come down the center of the building. The whole thing was going to be kicked off by a large bomb lowered down the central shaft of the building. So this building is sort of hollow, if you like. At the bottom of that is a very large glass roof light. The idea was that they would get Taufik on the field telephone, this sort of military telephone they'd introduced. They'd measured the cord. So they calculated that if he was on the telephone, he had to be in the hallway. When the bomb went off, the whole of this glass and metal structure, about 2.5 tons of it, would land on top of Taufik al-Rashidi and give him, in Hector Gullen's phrase, a very close haircut. None of this went according to plan. Because for one thing, Taufik was on the telephone when the assault began, and I've heard the recordings of the conversation, and you can hear him saying, something's happening, while the police are trying to keep him talking. But actually, he'd wound the cord of the telephone up the banisters and was on the first floor landing. So when the bomb went off and this huge amount of metal and glass came crashing down, it missed him completely. The hostages were not in the room they were supposed to be in. They were in a different room. The abseilers begin to come down the back. This is the first shot of them doing so. It starts well. They come down in silence. On the right hand, though, you can see that's a man called Tommy Palmer whose foot has gone through that window. That noise alerted the gunman to the fact that an assault was in progress. The leader of this particular troop, a man called Tom Morell, was the last to come down to the balcony. And as he came down, his abseiling gear got snagged on the rope, unmovably. He couldn't go up and he couldn't go down. Meanwhile, his three mates have thrown thunder flashes into that room, which has burst into flames because it's soaked in petrol. So at this point, fire is beginning to pour out of the windows, and Tom Morell is suspended in midair being barbecued. Let's try the next one. Again, you see they're desperately trying to get him down. The windows are already on fire. Let's do the next one. At this point, Tommy Palmer on the left hand has had to tear off his rubber hood because it has begun to melt into his neck. He's also taken off the gas mask that he's wearing because it's also beginning to melt. He's the only person about to leap into this burning building whose face the gunman would actually see. Everybody else was wearing gas masks. It was an astonishingly brave thing. Tom Morell is still held up on the rope here. Meanwhile, the assault, by the way, he did get down. Eventually, they cut the rope, and he landed very, very hard on the balcony with third-degree burns. Nonetheless, the adrenaline was coursing, so he managed to burst into the building with everyone else. Meanwhile, the attack is taking place on the front. This is the famous sort of iconic photograph. And from the front of the building, behind the front wall, SAS marksmen with Polecat launchers are firing tear gas canisters into a room that they think is empty in order to create a kind of tear gas wall that will drift down through the building. Actually, that room was filled with hostages. They'd just been moved. So the first thing they knew of this assault were these tear gas canisters bashing through the windows, at which point the terrorists opened fire on them. Many of them were injured. Only one was killed. Next one, please. Sorry. There we go. And this is Sim Harris's balcony scene. So with his coat on fire, he is scrambling across the front. He's very funny about it, actually, because he says, why on earth were they taking me back into a burning building? I could simply have jumped onto the other balcony on the other side, and the Royal College of General Practitioners was not on fire. Nonetheless, they brought him down through there. That's him clambering around. Those are police marksmen, by the way, on the right, without any kind of protection. They're not wearing helmets. You would never see a picture like this today. Let's do the next one. There he is, and you can just see the one hand of the SAS guy grabbing him and pulling him into the building. Next one, please. There we go, back. As the hostages were being brought down, those that had survived, they were laid out on the lawn on the back, and they were plastic cuffed. Because, of course, the police and the SAS couldn't know which of them were genuine hostages and which ones were gunmen. And they were right not to know, because seconds after this, everyone would be handcuffed, would be plastic cuffed. But the man wearing the red jacket on the right is the one surviving gunman. His name was Fawzi Badawi Nejad. He was 18 years old. And he had really befriended the women hostages. He got on very, very well with them. Moments after this photograph was taken, Sim Harris identified him as one of the gunmen. He said, that is one of the terrorists. Get him at once. The SAS picked him up and were about to drag him off when the women gathered around him and said, don't kill him. Don't kill him. He's our brother. That's just, to me, the ultimate moment of Stockholm Syndrome expressing himself. Now, whether the SAS were intent on bringing him inside in order to finish him off, we'll probably never know. Different witnesses have different recollections of this moment. Next one, please. And that is Fawzi Badawi Nejad being dragged off in plastic cuffs by the police. The fire brigade has now arrived. Fawzi Badawi Nejad served 25 years in British prisons on terrorism charges. He's now been released. He can't go back to Iran. He's a wanted man. In a way, his story is almost as tragic as any of the others. He was ruined by this story. He was a naive 18-year-old. I'm not making a case for him. What he did was idiotic. But 18-year-old young men tend to do idiotic things. That doesn't excuse it. But it does, I think, give a certain context to what was happening. Nobody has ever really tried to investigate what these gunmen wanted, who they were, where they came from. And the same is also true of the SAS participants. These are, in a way, blank slates that, to me, seemed so tempting to try to fill in. Let's move to the next one, please. This is the first reunion of the hostages. Every year after this, every May bank holiday, they would gather in one of their houses to talk about what had happened to them. And in a way to try to come to terms with it, because These stories are very exciting and they're fascinating, but they're also extremely traumatic. Nobody comes out of this tale unscathed. And I include Trevor Locke in that. Trevor, you see him here. He's sitting down with the tie on. He looks very cheery. But to the end of his life, Trevor Locke felt an enduring sense of guilt because he hadn't taken that gun out and prevented the execution of Abbas Lavassani. But he did take his gun out. It's a very dramatic moment, and if you want to know what happened, you have to buy the book. So finally, Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher and Dennis turned up in Regent's Park Barracks as the party was taking place on that evening, as the beer was being broken out. They were all still soaked in tear gas. They were wearing their combat gear. And this huge party was taking place. And she sort of moved among them in a way that only she would be able to do. She was very at ease with military people. Although at one point they were trying to watch themselves on television because this was running on a loop. And she had very big hair in those days. And she moved across in front of the television. They all told her, "Sit down, woman," which was not really how you talk to Margaret Thatcher. But people noticed at this point, she was an adept politician, Margaret Thatcher, and she was brilliant at this. People noticed as she was moving among the SAS that she had a tear in her eye as she was going around. Now, maybe that was emotion. It's my view that it was probably tear gas. Because Thatcher didn't cry that easily. But this became the defining moment of the early part of her premiership. And as I say, it was a huge gamble. She was warned that there were likely to be 40% casualties in that building, at best, that 4 out of 10 people, both the SAS and the hostages and the gunmen, 40% of them would be killed or injured. In fact, it was an incredibly low tally. Only of the SAS, only one soldier was injured by shooting off his own finger. Everybody else got away. There were 2 dead hostages. It was an astonishing success. And she traded on it. She traded on it for the rest of her premiership. But had it gone the other way, had it flipped round, Thatcher would probably have been unseated. The whole story of our island would have been very different, I think. It would have come to a very premature end. The SAS would probably have been disbanded. There was already pressure on the SAS. They were considered to be a sort of rogue group. They weren't under proper military control, people felt. So they were endangered anyway. So it does change our history. And this book turned out to be very different from the book that I thought I was going to write. As a young boy, I was 17, I found this event so exciting, so dramatic, so unbelievable, really. I genuinely thought that our old black and white television had just gone wrong, that somehow we were watching a film that had sort of turned up. And I found that so exciting and so dramatic that I think it's one of the reasons why I wanted to be a news journalist. I wanted to write about events like that taking place. Of course, we're used to it now. We're used to having live television sort of fed into our living rooms as a sort of matter of course. Anyone with an iPhone can do live television. Then it was completely unheard of. This was totally unprecedented. And so I inherited this very dramatic, probably rather simplistic view of what had happened. And as I researched this story, I found a much more complicated and in a way a much more interesting story than the one I had grown up with. And it turned out really to be a story. It is partly a story about daring do and adventure and guns and so on, but it is also a story about what perfectly ordinary people do in extraordinary circumstances. So none of those people in the embassy had any idea that on that morning they were going to be dragged into this extraordinary and terrifying drama. And they all responded in subtly different ways. We'd all like to think, wouldn't we, that in those circumstances, we would behave in ways that would be creditable to us, that our friends and families would find admirable. But you can't know that. You cannot know how you will respond to lethal jeopardy until you are in that situation. And some behaved with great poise and great resilience, and others were desperate to survive and cut corners and did things that they, in later life, felt very guilty about. So I suppose one of the things that this book tries to do, in practice, perhaps the main thing that it tries to do, is to ask a very simple question, which I think, I hope, all sort of popular history really asks. And that is the simple question, if you had been inside that embassy on that May bank holiday in 1980, what would you have done? Thank you. Thank you so much.
Lovely. Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Now we have time for questions, and people with yellow cards, if you put up your hand, we'll come and find you with a microphone. Lovely. Hang on one second. There we go. Lovely.
You couldn't make it up, could you?
No, you couldn't.
Could you talk a bit about how you think what happened then and what's happening now? Can you talk about a bit about what you think is, you know, how that relates to what's going on now in the Iranian conflict?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that the Thatcher government hoped to achieve by this was they hoped that with a bloodless ending to this story, they would somehow be able to establish diplomatic relations with Iran, that it might open a new chapter in what had already become an extremely toxic relationship between the West and Iran. That didn't happen. It's never happened. It's still the holy grail of diplomacy in the Middle East, is to try to get Tehran to talk. And I think then, and in the intervening years, and now, we still don't really understand Iran. We think of it as being a place, it is a very civilized place, these are highly literate people, but the sort of traumatic effect of that revolution, it is unlike anything else in later 20th century history. It utterly traumatized an entire nation. So what we see in the West as an aggressive, brutal power determined to dominate the Middle East with nuclear weapons, they don't see it that way. They're an ancient empire. They see particularly Britain as being a meddling power that has tried to use them over time. So there is still this huge gulf of misunderstanding. And I'm not making a case for Iran. It's a brutal, despotic theocracy. But it's melded up with our history. And I think this shows it. This is one of the many illustrations of how Iran and the West simply don't speak the same language. Yes, please. Any other thoughts on this or anything else? There's a gentleman there. You've been yellow carded, sir. There is actually a yellow card point in this story. The yellow card was the thing that the SAS were issued with when they went into what they call kinetic operations. And the yellow card was a rule that said you may open fire on someone if they have a weapon and have not surrendered. That was the yellow card rule, was how they went in. Yes, sir.
Thank you. That was extremely evocative, if I might call it that. It's a really rather dull question, actually, but it's about the preparation. You spent some time talking about the audio intelligence that was gathered, but you also showed pictures of identikit pictures of the terrorists. Were there any video probes put in?
They did try to put a video probe in. It never really worked. I've seen bits of it. It's incredibly crackly and vague. And even by day six, they hadn't really got it right. The audio worked much better. The photographs you see are sort of composites based on huge numbers of photographs that were being taken by both the snipers who were placed around the building and in neighboring buildings, and police cameramen hidden in the trees. So every time one of those gunmen appeared on the balcony or anywhere, or even just inside a window, a volley of camera shots were taken. They were then taken to a central place where they were then analyzed and examined to try to get an idea of what these people looked like, what clothes they were wearing. And it was extraordinarily detailed. They also attempted to kind of track them using infrared, very early infrared cameras that were supposed to pick up. But it didn't really work, because one of the things that the MI5 technicians reported was they said every morning all the hostages gather in the basement because we're picking them up on the infrared cameras. Actually, no, that was the timer on the central heating system that went off in the basement every morning at 8 o'clock. And so what they were picking up were just the radiators. So, I mean, it sounds silly now, but in fact, the technology for the time was extremely advanced. It was, you know, they were doing the best they could do. And they would do it very differently now. The idea that, you know, these guys had no way of communicating with the outside world. I mean, once the telephones had been switched off and only the police telephone was used to go back and forth, to have any kind of communication, to anyone under the age of sort of 30, that sounds baffling, because, of course, there were no mobile telephones, and the whole idea was that you just keep your mobile telephone and call someone outside. Although the Daily Mail did turn up with a thing called a mobile telephone, a very, very early thing in a kind of suitcase. that they arrived, and all the other journalists were incredibly envious of the Daily Mail for having this incredible piece of kit where you could call anywhere in the world just by picking it up and dialing the number. But what the Daily Mail didn't realize was that the man from the Times, I'm glad to say, had worked out that he could hack into this using just a radio ham transmitter. So he was stealing all the Daily Mail stories, which is wonderful. And it's a very early and honorable example of phone hacking. It's a yellow card in the corner. There we go.
Police were partly located in a Montessori school close by.
They were.
The context of that is I've heard Dower speak, and minutes after 1907, when he'd handed, you know this story, after he'd handed over control to Mike Rose, he went to the Montessori school loo, which had very low urinals. He was stood next to an SAS sniper, who evidently couldn't hit a target from about 3 feet. And he rather regretted handing over control to Mike Rose. So.
Very good. Very good story. I didn't know that. I did know that when they moved into the... So they started off in the Royal College of Needlework, which was number 22. But that didn't work because all the policemen smoked and there were beautiful ancient tapestries around the walls. So they were thrown out of the Royal College of Needlework and moved into the Montessori Nursery School, which, as you're absolutely right, the urinals were that high. So these huge bobbies had to kind of kneel down in order to use these things. And they had tiny little chairs, which, of course, bobbies with their enormous bottoms couldn't get anywhere in at all. But I didn't know that they'd actually been there. But in fact, they moved very quickly from zero control, which was on the top floor of the Montessori school, to the back of the building as the police and the SAS were bringing everybody out. But again, it's one of the sort of inadvertently comic aspects of this. Yes, sir. Madam, forgive me.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to ask a question because you said at the beginning that Margaret Thatcher took an incredible risk with this and that otherwise the country may have gone in a different direction if the gamble hadn't paid off. I wonder if you could just give us some of your thoughts regarding that.
Well, it also became in a way the leitmotif of her premiership, because forever after this, whenever Thatcher did something particularly resolute or dramatic, newspaper cartoonists would portray her in full combat gear, kind of abseiling down the outside of Big Ben. It became the absolutely kind of central image, if you like, of what she did. And some people, and I think there's justification in this, see her approach to the Falklands conflict as being framed in some ways by this incident. She believed she had a very close relationship with the military, and she did actually. But some people see her use of the SAS in the Falklands and elsewhere as being part of a kind of rather gung-ho attitude towards special forces that has lasted ever since. I think she was very proud of it. I think she felt that she really had taken a big risk and that it had paid off. And it really did. So it sort of followed her, if you like. And of course, Thatcher being Thatcher, and to put it in more context, 6 days before this assault, American special forces had attempted to liberate the 55 American hostages held in the Tehran embassy. That was a calamity. It was called Operation Eagle Claw, and it went appallingly badly wrong. Several servicemen died. They never got off the ground. Helicopters were supposed to go into it. It was ghastly. It didn't work. So this event was taking place in the shadow of that event. So Thatcher and her advisors were terribly keenly aware that if it went wrong, they were done. I mean, Carter's presidency never recovered from the failure of Operation Eagle Claw. So I think she knew perfectly well just what she was dealing with. But also, being Thatcher, she couldn't resist calling up the Oval Office afterwards and saying, "Jimmy, if you ever need any help, we're here for you. Just let us know." We've got time for one more question.
Thank you. That was a fantastic talk. I was just curious, you mentioned that Thatcher was hoping to use this as a watershed moment to reestablish diplomacy. What was the reaction to the siege as it was going on in Iran, and what were the repercussions?
Well, it's very interesting. It was very closely covered in Iran. I mean, it got daily coverage. Initially, it was assumed to be a CIA plot. As I said, it was thought to be the Americans behind it. When they were disabused of that quite quickly, they rightly surmised that it must be an Iraqi plot, which it clearly was, although British intelligence didn't discover that until sometime later. There was such deep distrust of the West in Iran by this point that almost no outcome was gonna make things better. At one point, the Iranian government said, unless you get our diplomats out of here, we are going to advise students to attack the building. I mean, they were that close to allowing this kind of mass attack by students. And there were real fears that that could take place. So, but in the longer view of history, it didn't make any difference. It didn't improve relations with Iran. Any kind of gratitude they thought was going to come didn't happen, because that's not how the Iranian government worked then. And alas, it's not how the Iranian government works now. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.